We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for this program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about estate planning. It's something that actually was a listener request. So we hope that folks out there, if you have questions that has to do with estate planning, and here we're talking about things like wills and trusts, we're talking about issues of probate, we're talking about issues of taxes, all of that, and whatever questions you may have, we certainly welcome them. And we have as our guest this morning, John Elder. He's an attorney with the firm of Meyer Capel in Champaign. He's been working in the area of estate planning for quite a long time. He has a lot of experience in the area. Before going to work at the law firm, he was the manager of planned services for Country Life Insurance Company, and before that, he was vice president and trust officer for Bank of Illinois, which is now Busey. And he's here in studio with us, and we'll try to ask questions that deal with the basics. But for people who are listening, if you have specific questions about your own situation, give us a call and give us the information, and I'm sure that John will do his best to help you out and give you an answer. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and we also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You can also send an email if you'd rather do that, will-talk@wilo.edu. Thanks very much for being here.
It's good to be here.
I appreciate it. One of the things that I came across in trying to think about this was this kind of question that, you know, people are asked, do you have an estate plan? And I think a lot of people say, well, no, because I don't have an estate. And people think, well, estates, that's something that very rich people have. Well, if you've got property, you have things you want to pass on to somebody else after you're gone, you've got an estate.
That's correct. And whether you have a large estate or a small estate, the one you have is the most important one to you.
Yeah.
And so many people, when you really get them down and ask them, what do you own? They own a lot more than they think they do.
Yeah. So really, we are talking about a will, something as basic as a will, but also we can talk about trusts, or we can talk particularly about things like advanced directives, living will, durable power of attorney, those sorts of things that really should be all part of this kind of package of things that people should be thinking about.
Well, and also how they own their assets, what assets do they have, how do they own them, what difference does it make? All of those things, including the ones you've mentioned, are what we're talking about.
Well, we've already got a caller here, so we will not make them wait, and we'll go right to them, and it's somebody who is in Indiana. So our toll-free line four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned about the control of what property and monies I have when I die. I live with a woman. We're not married. I don't anticipate family members trying to stop anything, but I thought it might, for the general public, if you could give some general tips, if it's not particularly specific to, you know, each and every state that one lives in. I wonder if you just give some tips about that sort of situation, whether it's a particular way to write the thing or how you go about it, something like that. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I think the best answer for the caller is that if you haven't done any planning, if you don't have a will, for example, each state has a procedure that they will require be followed if you die without a will. That's called intestacy. And those statutes, and I don't know every state, but those statutes generally provide that a spouse or children inherit your property if you haven't made other provisions. So if you're living with a significant other, they're not going to have the same rights by default that a spouse would. And if you're living with a lady and you have children and you die without a will, your children are going to have the priority to receive those assets. So this individual and anyone else in this position needs to – you can leave your property to whoever you want to. I mean, there's no right of children to inherit. There are some rights of spouses to receive some portion of an estate, but mostly you can do what you want with your assets. So if this individual wants to provide for this lady, he needs to get a will, name her as executor, for example, leave her whatever assets he wants, provide for his children how he wants. He can take care of this problem, but he has to initiate the will in order to do that.
Mm-hmm. And just as far as dying intestate is concerned, even if one is married, you have a married couple and children, then the law is going to and there's no will. The state has a formula that they apply for dividing up the property. And perhaps one reason for someone to want to have a will is that the state may not do it the way you want it done. And so you might assume, for example, the largest share would go to the spouse. Well, that's not the way that it works. And you just need to make sure, however you want it to happen, you specify in a legal document that it go that way.
Well, I always use the example, David, that if you don't own anything but a car, and you own a car in your own name, and you're married and have a 2-year-old child, and you die without a will, and you own the car just in your name, the wife owns half and the 2-year-old owns half. Now, you need a will. Now, if you put your wife's name on the car and it's owned jointly, then the car will become hers. Mm-hmm. But if you die and don't have a will, all of a sudden the spouse is involved with setting up an account for the 2-year-old to receive half the proceeds. It applies to everyone. It isn't just the big estate that has to deal with this.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that there are probably people who would ask a question, say we have a married couple, and the property that they have is either owned jointly. So let's say they have a home, there's joint ownership. They have a car, there's joint ownership. They have bank accounts, and they have both of their names. And perhaps then any other sorts of assets, accounts, retirement plans, and so forth, the surviving spouse is listed as the beneficiary. So there's no doubt that if the one person dies, the person that remains gets it. So you figure, well, it's all sort of set up, either jointly owned or with right of the rights of the person to have ownership. So with someone like that, I'm sure that they would say, well, since everything is set up like that, why do I need to have a will?
Well, there are times when I say to people, you don't need one.
Hmm.
Of course, the issue in that case is, do they have children? If they have children and everything goes to the survivor, then at the second death, it will go to the children. But if they don't have children, then what's happening is the one that dies first leaves it to the second spouse.
Hmm.
Then the second spouse is going to leave it all to their family. And the first spouse's brothers and sisters and parents aren't going to receive anything. So it may be that without a will, you handle the first death, but all of a sudden at the second death, it's individually owned property.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to kind of follow in with what you're saying, the will only applies to assets in your own name. So if you own assets jointly or payable on death or beneficiary designation, the will has nothing to do with those. So your example is a good one until the first person dies.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second person better hurry and run in and get a will to leave it to the right people.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller here. This is someone who is in Urbana and line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Another issue is if you have children and there's possibilities of both parents dying in rapid succession and who do you want to have the guardianship for your child, and setting up backup guardians, because who knows what the situation is going to be for the guardians down the road. I think kids are as important as your assets. We finally got one of our kids, grown kids, to get his will set up, and it was partly because they've got kids now. He had trouble getting a lawyer to agree to do a will. He lives in another state, and he finally did it based on our old wills when we had kids, and he did it himself. And now he's got multiple copies of the will, and we're wondering where do you keep wills when you don't have a lawyer's office to keep them in? I know you're not supposed to have them in a safe deposit box, but somebody's got to be able to find the will in the event of a death. What do you recommend?
Well, the adage that you shouldn't have the will in the safe deposit box was something from, I'm going to say, 15, 20 years ago, when there used to be an inheritance tax and there was restrictions on getting into a lockbox. But and I can only speak definitively for Illinois, but I think most states have done the same thing. There's nothing wrong with putting a will in a lockbox anymore. If you have a death and you go to the bank and can show that the person passed away, you can get into the lockbox. But even if you leave the will in the lockbox, most all of us have some place where we keep our business records at home. It may be at the desk, or it may be in the nightstand beside the bed, or wherever your papers are kept. And there should be a note there. Either the will should be with those papers, or if you've put it in the lockbox, you can have a note with your other papers that says where the will is located. But the main thing is to communicate to people not only about where the will is, but what are your burial instructions and all those things about your death. If you have that in some envelope and can say to your kids, hey, something happens to us, right over there in that drawer is all my stuff. That's probably the best option.
Another thing to consider is your estate with regard to your passwords on websites, your financial passwords, this kind of thing. And that's another interesting question. How do you keep them safe, and yet how do you make them accessible so that your affairs can be accessed when you die, or if you become incapacitated and somebody needs to take over for you?
Well, obviously that's a very important issue that we're now developed with, but and we didn't used to have that. I think the answer is almost the same as the will. You either keep it in the lockbox, because where someone can have access at your death, they can't just get in there if they're not on the signature card. Or you have some place at home that you can lock. My wife and I have that. We have one drawer where we can lock our drawer if we're going to be out of town or something. And in those locations with these other estate planning documents, it is very helpful if you say what your passwords are. I will tell you that we had an individual who was killed about a year and a half ago by a train hit him. And my assistant had to spend 3 days trying every password we could think of and got into like 90% of the accounts and all. But it would have been a lot easier to have had a list and known to go find that somewhere in the lockbox or somewhere else. So it's a very good question.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you for the call. Other questions are welcome. We're talking this morning about estate planning. Our guest is John Elder. He's an attorney with the firm of Meyer Capel in Champaign and has been working in this area for quite a long time. So he has a lot of experience. If you have questions, and we're really talking about things like wills and trusts, you have some questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And, you know, perhaps it's also worth mentioning, I think that the issue of inheritance and division of property after someone's death can be very stressful, and it can rip families up. And I'm sure that you have seen this happen many times. So, again, I suppose one reason to be as specific as you can be about what you want to happen with your property will, to some extent, prevent that from happening.
Yeah, the interesting thing, David, is that what makes my job hard is I'm talking usually with the parents about how they want to deal with their children and what are their children like. And because in some cases I've met the children, but in many, many cases I haven't. The ones where we really have problems are where the parents die. And then these kids walk in and tell you what the parents told them was going to happen. And child one heard one thing, child two heard something else, child three heard a third interpretation. And so the parents that have trouble relating to their children are the ones that have the most problems in their estates. But they're the same ones that when I ask a question, usually they've gotten in that position because they can't see what's going on. They won't face the reality of their own children. So I ask the parents, do your children get along? Yes. But when you get involved, you find out they never got along, at least the way the kids look at it. So you try to encourage people to provide as equally for their children as possible. Now, if there's a unique situation, one of them has a health condition or something. But I was telling somebody the other day, no matter if you have one child that's worth $50 million and another child worth $50,000, if you don't give them equal, the child is going to be hurt, not because they want the money, because they want to think they were loved equally by the parents. Mm-hmm. And any time you favor one child, somebody's going to be hurt over that. And usually you've ruined the relationship between your kids, which is not what you usually want to do.
What, is it always necessary that you choose someone to be executor? And that, it seems to me that that also can be can end up being a real burden for the person who's the executor. And then if they are having to negotiate between their siblings and surviving relatives, that can also be very difficult for that person.
Sure. You have to have an executor to make the decisions and to administer the transfer of the assets and the gathering of the assets and to provide input to the family. The lawyer does a lot of the paperwork, but someone has to say, yes, we'll take that price for the house, or we'll sell this car this way or that way. Your choices of an executor are a family member or a friend, or perhaps an advisor, like your accountant or lawyer, or a corporate trustee or executor. And everybody shies away from the corporate executor because it's too costly. But when you really watch what happens to the family dynamics when one child is in the middle trying to administer the estate, sometimes the money you spend on that corporate executor so that all the kids are close and dislike the executor, sometimes it's worth the money.
We have some other callers here. In fact, the lines are full, so we'll get to first someone on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. The first one is, in Illinois, if a husband and wife were in a car accident and they're both killed, who's presumed to have died first?
There's no evidence of how they died.
Yeah.
I mean, by the time someone gets to the scene of the accident, they're both deceased. They're each assumed to have survived.
Okay.
So if the wife owns some assets and the husband owns some assets, the wife's assets will pass as if she lived the longest, and the husband's assets will pass as if he lived the longest. And if they own things jointly, their half of that asset will pass according to what they would have done.
Okay. Second question. I was convinced that I should put a trust, a living trust with my will because I talked about things might change in the future and I might want to do different things. And I was so, and taxes may change. A lot of things might change, and then my trust would be easier to change periodically than going through the whole will process again. Is that correct? Would that make sense?
Well, you can change a trust by merely doing an amendment, and it doesn't require the formality of witnesses like a will does.
Yeah, that's what I'm told.
If we have a trust and you call me and you say, I want to change my trust, I can retype what you want, mail it to you, you sign it and send it back and it's done.
Yeah.
If it's a will, you got to come in and sign in front of witnesses and a notary.
All right. Is there another reason you should go to a trust rather than just a will?
Well, if you die owning your assets in your own name, then if it's in excess of 100,000 of assets, we have to probate that through the court process. And if the assets are actually in a trust, if you've set up a trust and you've changed the ownership so that you own them in the trust, then you don't have to go through that probate process, which oftentimes is expensive, so it may be advantageous.
Yeah. Well, today that affects a lot of people. That's a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money compared to what it used to be.
That's correct.
Finally, I was convinced that I should never go to an individual, even a lawyer, but to go to, say, a financial institution and make them executor because even though people might change, they're constantly audited and a lot safer than, and certainly not a family member because they get angry. So does that make sense to go to that as an executor?
I've got,
you know, fairly substantial things that I'll leave. So, and I'd like to, and they'll be left over a period of many years because of grandchildren. So I just wondered if that's correct, that I'm better off to go to a bank as an executor.
I think the professional executor trustee, like a bank, has a lot of advantages in a larger size estate. The negative you have is that they charge a fee that may be more costly than a family member or someone else. But if your estate is large enough, I think the things that are brought to the table by the corporate trustee are very positive. I suppose the one thing I do now that I didn't do 20 years ago is that I let the beneficiaries remove the corporate trustee and name another one, because with all the bank mergers and things that are happening, oftentimes the institution you end up with is not what you intended, and you might want to let your kids not be able to fire the trustee and do it themselves, but at least get rid of that trustee and name a bank that's local and more favorable.
Good thought. I appreciate that. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Thank you. Just one more quick question. And we have talked a little bit about, and this was someone who had wrote an email about choosing the executor. We have talked with that a little bit, but just in addition to what we have discussed, the listener wants to know if you're choosing some sort of professional person to do this. So it could be an accountant, a financial advisor. It could be somebody who works for a bank or so forth. What should you expect to pay for the service?
The costs are if you hire some people, it may be they charge on an hourly basis for their time. Some institutions have fee schedules that are increased by or determined by the value of the assets they're managing. Mm-hmm. But I think that's an important item to negotiate with whoever you've named. If you have an estate of $1 million and you own 300 different stocks to get there, that's a lot more costly for it to be administered than if you own $1 million estate and it's all AT&T stock, one stock. Mm-hmm. So that's an item that should be negotiated. But it's usually based on the value of the assets or some type of time schedule.
All right. Back to callers. Danville is our next, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
My first will, I left most of my estate to my surviving son and the balance to various charities. Then I amended it to change the dollar amounts to percentage amounts. And I will add that WILL is among those. Now I've been accumulating CDs, and I would like to add some more charities as just a payable on death for that particular CD, rather than having to, redraw a will again. I'm told by two financial institutions that I can't do that. Is that so?
I think financial institutions have concerns about having payable on death accounts to charities because the name of the organization may change, and then they're in the position of deciding who's to receive these assets. I mean,
they don't put it that way. They put it that an individual has a Social Security number and they don't have a specific number for that particular charity, as well established and well known as it may be.
Well, I would have to talk to the institution, but every organization, including charities, have a tax ID number.
Sure.
And so I don't know the institution. I'm not sure I want to know the institution, but I think the issue is more from a legal standpoint, the concern of a POD to a charity is what happens if that organization isn't there, but there's been an outgrowth of another organization. Where with an individual, if it's payable on death to your son, if your son's alive, he gets it. If he's not, he doesn't. So going back to your question, though, there's one other thing. You talked about sometimes you leave a dollar amount and sometimes you leave percentages.
No, in the first will, I left dollar amounts. In the second, in the revision, I just made percentages.
Okay. And the difference in those two, I think, is based usually upon the size of what you're giving and your intent. If you want to leave a set amount to WILL, then you put in a paragraph that says, I leave $10,000 to WILL or $50,000 or whatever. If your focus is really ultimately charitable giving and you want to give a 25% to four different charities, then you're allowing either the growth in the assets or, if they go down in value, the decrease in the assets. The charity is either increasing or decreasing. And so the real question in choosing between a set amount or a percentage amount is, you know, do you really want the charity to benefit if there's a growth, or do you just want to leave them $10,000 or $25,000? It's just kind of a philosophical, what is your main focus in your documents?
Well, yes, I have left 45% to several charities, and it's just that there are two or three additional charities that I don't want to have to redraw the will. I just wanted to have it, you know, obviously the CDs will go into my estate, and the CDs will amount to over $100,000, and I just thought that some of those I could have as POD to a specific charity without having to redraw the will, but it looks as though there may be some difficulties in that.
Yeah, well, if your institutions won't do it, I would think economically the cost of a codicil to your will, just to change that paragraph and say, I leave the 45% to six charities instead of four. That might cost $100 or so, but I wouldn't think that would be a big item.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll go on here, and next we'll talk with someone in Urbana on our line number three. Hello.
Hi. Do you have any advice for people whose family members die and there's no will, and or there are family people who might be how to put this? I have a friend who has relatives who went into the house and took things. This happened in our own family many, many years ago. Do you have suggestions about things to watch out for and wait to prevent nefarious people who have access to a home to keep them from doing that? And what kinds of things can go wrong? How would you suggest that people watch out for the estate of a family member? Thanks.
Well, no matter how good a will is, or no matter how well a trust is drafted, if someone's going in and steal the things before it gets started, I don't have a good answer for that. It happens, not a lot, but it happens. Sometimes it's helpful if I have people who take pictures of their house to show what assets they have. I have people who list memorandums of property. And on that memorandum, they list their specific items. And if you go into the house the day after they die and there's a space over there in the living room and the picture shows that there was the antique hutch from great-grandma was there, you got to start finding out who had access to the house and where'd the hutch go. It goes back to what I tried to say maybe 15 minutes ago, and that is that as I talk to the parent or the grandparent about the estate, if I say, do you have problems with your children, the one that really does have a problem usually won't tell me that. And then all of a sudden I'm involved in an estate where I thought the kids would get along, and lo and behold, one of them's already stripped the house. But, you know, the only thing I can say is if you're in a family and you have a dying parent, the last parent dying, and you know your siblings are going to go in there and take things out of the house, well, then you need to go in and act and lock it up ahead of time or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't have a good answer when somebody's already gone in there and taken the stuff out.
Yeah. I suppose the thing that you talked about, the making sure that you have a record of those things that you consider your most valuable items, I would think even just for insurance purposes, really you should have such a record. I think, in fact, a lot of insurance companies, they say, well, we want you to document these things that you have. If you're going to, if there's some sort of possibility that in the future you might be making a claim, well, we need for you to document these items, what they are, what you think the value of them are. And so that would be probably just on general principles a good thing to do.
Sure. But unfortunately, documenting your assets and the value of your assets is about as pleasant as doing a will in a trust.
We're talking this morning about estate planning, and our guest is local attorney John Elder, and we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, is a group that brings together state legislators and representatives of large corporations to draft model bills. An archive of ALEC documents was recently leaked to the Center for Media and Democracy. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with journalist John Nichols of The Nation about what these documents reveal. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here during the week with 10 different topics. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk with Romeo Dallaire. He is a retired general from the Canadian Armed Forces. He was the commander of UN peacekeepers in Rwanda in the early 90s. And we'll talk about a book that he's written that deals with an issue now that he has taken on, child soldiers. His book is titled They Fight Like Soldiers, They Die Like Children, The Global Quest to Eradicate the Use of Child Soldiers. Then tomorrow in the second hour, we'll have another of the programs we're calling the Deep Archives. These are things that we're doing to celebrate the fact that this year we turned 30 on this program. We'll be on the air 30 years, and we have gone back into some of our oldest recorded programs, things that haven't been heard in a long time, aren't as a part of the web archive. And both of the programs have to do one way or another with computers, the way technology changes our life. So you'll hear some of a conversation that Jack Brighton had with Howard Rheingold in 2000. He's a guy well known about writing about things like computer communities, virtual realities. And then an interview that I did way back in 1987 with social critic Jeremy Rifkin about a book that he authored titled Time Wars, which is about how our experience of time changes over time. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. And go to our website, which is will.illinois.edu, and listen to Pat's shows and find out what we'll do in the days ahead. In this hour of Focus, we're talking about estate planning, and we have several callers here. We'll get right back to them. Our guest is John Elder. He is an attorney with the firm of Meyer Capel in Champaign and has been doing this for quite a while. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Back here to the phones, and our next caller will be on line two. Hello.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question. If one has more than $100,000 outside of a trust, does the whole thing go into probate or just the amount that's outside the trust?
Just the amount that's outside the trust.
Okay.
And it's also assets in a trust that have a provision for beneficiaries. Those aren't probated. You don't probate joint tenancy property payable to a survivor. You don't probate insurance and retirement plans and assets that name a beneficiary. So the only thing you probate are individually held assets that don't designate a beneficiary. Those are the ones you probate.
Okay. And overall, what type of trust would you consider probably to be the best option?
For leaving to children, or what is your...
Yes, children, grandchildren, etc.
Well, there's two ways to establish a trust for estate planning. One is to have a will and have the trust language in the will. Now, that you have to probate, because you start with you own the assets, but your will says, when I die, put my assets in a trust. Your other option is to have a will that says, if I own things in my name, put them in the trust. But you actually have a separate document called a living trust, and you set that living trust up and you put the documents in, or put the assets in that trust during your lifetime. And I suppose if your goal is to ease administration and not have probate, having an actual living trust set up with a will that puts things into it if you haven't put them in during your lifetime is the best option.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Just for a second here, and we have some other callers that we get to. I think it would be a good idea for you to talk a little bit more about probate and exactly what it is. The term has come up several times here, and I think if there's one thing people know about probate is you want to avoid it if you possibly can. That's what a big part of estate planning, I think, is avoiding probate. Well, what is probate, and why do you want to avoid it?
Well, the first thing is I don't know that you start with the premise you want to avoid probate. The issue between I'd like to have a simple will and just leave things to my children versus I'd like to pay to have a trust set up and go through the formality of establishing a trust and putting your assets in the trust and then having the trust give it to your children. The negative of the trust is it costs more. Maybe the will, a will that provides for your family and names an executor and leaves things outright, might cost $250, and the trust might cost $1,500 to $2,000. So if someone doesn't have a real large estate, you don't want to pay $2,000 for trust when you could do the same thing and presume you have children that get along and aren't going to be doing these horrible things we talk about. Mm-hmm. You don't want to pay $2,000 for something you can get for $250. On the other hand, if you have an estate that's going to result in probate, then the question becomes, well, how complicated is that? The probate process is designed to provide two things. Number one, a way to have the court say this person's the executor, whether through the will or through the intestacy law, and they're the ones empowered to go get these assets. So if there's an asset in the name of John Elder, bank account in the name of John Elder, and I die, nobody can get that money until the judge empowers someone to be able to be executor and go get it. So the probate process allows the administration, and the other advantage of probate is it cuts off creditors so that if you have a trust and the assets are all distributed and lo and behold, the decedent owed somebody some money, they may have a claim to go against the family and say, give those things back. There was a debt. In probate, you publish in the paper and you tell the whole world that the decedent died, and if they owed money, you have 6 months to tell it, and if you don't do it, then you receive things through probate and cut off the creditors. Hmm. And so there are often times when we will end up probating an estate because the cost of the probate is worth being able to define the creditors and not have them coming back 2 or 3 years later.
All right. Very good. Well, get back to the calls. Champaign County, line one right here. Hello.
Good morning, all. Mm-hmm. I appreciate WLL for providing this program, and I also appreciate Mr. Elder for taking his valuable time to share his knowledge and answer questions. And my question has to do about revocable trust. Are there any benefits and tax advantages to having a revocable trust?
Well, if your tax question is, will a revocable trust allow you to get assets out of your estate so that when you die, you don't have as big of an estate that's taxable, the answer is no. If you have a revocable trust and you still retain control over those assets, then those assets will be in your taxable estate the same as if you'd owned them outright. Oftentimes, the trust you set up, though, can provide things like generation skipping. You can set up a revocable trust that you can change, but once you die, it provides maybe the income to your children for their lifetime, but it passes on to your grandchildren. There's some tax planning in a revocable trust, but it doesn't remove the asset from the estate of the person setting up the trust. Mm. Does that answer your question?
Well, but then if, you know, it's owned by, well, there's a couple, and one of the spouses dies, so then, as I understand it, the trust becomes irrevocable. Does that have an impact on taxes at all?
Sure. I mean, in Illinois, we're a separate property state. Illinois is a state where a husband can own assets and the wife can own assets, and they actually own whatever's in their name.
Right.
You have other states that are called community property states where, for example, Texas, more in the Southwest, Texas and some of those states, California, have community property. And whether it's in the husband's name or the wife's name, it's owned by both of them. just by state law. So you have to determine what kind of state you reside in. But in the Midwest, we're mostly separate property. And if the wife has a trust and the husband has a trust and they both have their own assets in those trusts, they're revocable. But once one dies, usually the decedent's trust becomes irrevocable. And then there can be planning to let the surviving spouse maybe have the use of the funds but not have it outright to them in a way where it's in their estate. So there's tax planning, but not usually to the person that sets up the trust.
Right, yeah. Tax planning for the survivors.
That's right.
Okay, very good. Okay, thanks, John.
All right, very well. Thank you for the call. And again, to another caller, and this would be Danville, line 3. Hello.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Very good topic today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's my question. My grandmother died about a year ago, and she didn't sign the will. She had one. She never signed it. She did have a living will, and I believe that really doesn't matter, but I want to mention that. Her estate is less than $20,000. She had given me the authority to take care of all her burial and pay all of her remaining bills last year, and I did that. Now, what is my first step in getting everything settled regarding her estate?
Okay, we've talked about the fact that the will only applies to individually held assets.
And that's her house.
Okay, she has a home?
She did have a home, yes.
Okay, and that's the only asset she has, or did she have a bank account and some other
things? She also has two bank accounts.
Okay.
And that's totally it.
And is the value of the equity in the home and the value of the two bank accounts above $100,000 or under $100,000?
Under $100,000.
Okay. Well, even though we talk about the fact that you have to probate individually held assets, there's a provision in the state of Illinois that's called the Small Estates Affidavit. And it's a document that you can use if the total of the individually held assets is under $100,000. You can fill out an affidavit. It's a form that the state of Illinois has developed. You can take that affidavit and you can go to the banks and you can say to the bank, give me the money and I'm not going to probate. I'm not going to file any documents or become executor. But give me the money because it's under $100,000 and you can gather those funds. Were you Danville? Is that where you were from?
I am in Danville, but she's from Decatur.
Okay, so she's in Macon County.
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, usually, I don't know that an individual can go do this, but usually an attorney can go to the title company, explain that there's a house and that the estate's under $100,000. And usually some documentation can be signed saying that if there are creditors, that you'll be responsible for the creditors. But there are ways that we, usually in our office, would be able to take that case and get the house sold and get you the money and get the two bank accounts transferred to you, and then you take the cash and pay the bills that you've had to pay and then distribute the balance to whoever the family members are, like children or whatever. There's an informal procedure as long as the total of the individually held assets is under $100,000.
All right. I love you. I don't know you, but I love you.
Well, not everybody feels that way, so I'm glad.
I can call your office to possibly set something up.
Sure.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
All right.
Have a great
day.
Well,
thank you for the call. We have just about 6-7 minutes left with John Elder from the law firm of Meyer Capel in Champaign. We're talking about estate planning, and we have two other callers. We'll try to get them both in the time that remains and go right to the next. Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
I have a will, and it goes to my son. I'm divorced. But what the house would be, that's, you know, you don't have to mention that specifically. That would be divided up then, right, or not, or what happens there?
Now, what?
I'm the only one that's on the house at this point.
You're living in the house?
Right.
And is the house in your name?
Yeah.
And you're divorced?
Right.
And you have a child?
Well, there's two, but it's going to divide up equally in terms of my other assets. Retirement program, that kind of thing.
Yes. If you don't have a will and you die owning this house in your own name,
mm-hmm.
it'll go equally to your two children.
Okay. So you're talking, I guess what sort of, because the house is over $100,000, but the reality, that's not the thing you were talking about before.
Well, if the house is over $100,000 and it's in your own name, then you're probably going to have to go have someone appointed executor and administer your estate and get someone allowed to sell the house or whatever you want to do with the house.
Yeah, my son's the administrator at this point on the will.
Okay. Well, your son's going to have to do a little paperwork and administer the estate. And if he sells the house, for example, then he'll take his half the proceeds and he'll give the other half to his sibling.
Yeah. Okay, great program.
All right, very good. One more then. We'll go here to somebody in Champaign. This is line four. Hello.
Yeah, David, thanks. Time is short, so I appreciate you taking my call, and I'll make this real short. Just two real quick points. One, to echo what your guest said, I was a trustee of a trust some 15 years ago, and money does strange things to strange people, I guess, but I would urge anybody who's considering doing a trust not only tie up your finances, in other words, who gets what bank account, but also be very, very careful as to who gets a dining room table, a chair, or something like that, because I can tell you, unfortunately, from personal experience, it can get extremely messy and stressful. So take the time to list as many objects out as you can, because if you're looking for trouble, you'll find it. But my real quick question is, with this trust, it was between me and a cousin, the assets were divided, but then I had a sister, and she got a lesser amount. But the attorney who was handling it at the time called it, they called it a legatee. And I'm not an attorney, so I'm probably wrong. But I was wondering if your guest could define that and what that means in terms of the trust. And I'll go ahead and hang up. Thanks.
Okay. In the probate procedure, we have legatees and devisees. And they are the people that receive real estate or personal property. A devisee is an old term to receive real estate, and legatee is one who receives personal property. I'm not sure from the way you've presented this, I completely understand what your lawyer is saying about she's a legatee, but it may be that the attorney felt that because she was a family member, that she had certain rights because of the way the document was written. That kind of sounds like – it sounds to me like you're saying that the document provided you and the cousin were to get a certain amount of money and maybe she was to get something, but it wasn't as much as the other two of you. Is that correct?
The caller rang off, so
– Oh, okay. So I think it's probably a case where the attorney felt that this sister had some rights probably, and that if they didn't do certain things, maybe the sister had a lawsuit or come in and get a share. But I don't think I got enough information to answer that one.
Well, we're coming down here. We have a couple minutes left. There's something that we haven't talked about, at least I want to mention, and it's something that probably would be worth an entire program, but that I think now a lot of people, as a part of this process, their planning process, people are thinking about who they would like to designate to look after their interests if they're incapacitated, and they want to make clear either what they want done or what they don't want done, and so this is also the opportunity for people to have living wills, have durable power of attorneys, so that they can make some sort of statement about what they want, but that they can also be very clear in designating the person that they're saying, this is the person I'm giving the authority to make decisions to. And I think now more and more, as part of this whole process, these kinds of documents are also being drawn up.
Very, very important. And what I would like to say on that area, David, is that I usually begin my discussion with, do you have power of attorney for health care? Do you have a financial power of attorney? Mm-hmm. A lot of times the answer is no. So then we get into, okay, here's what a financial power of attorney does. It lets somebody have access to your money if you're incapacitated. The will only applies when you die. The power of attorney for health care is the person that walks into that emergency room and tells the doctor to do the surgery or to do the procedure or not. And so you say, who do you want to name to do this? Well, they start with, well, I better name my son. He'll be hurt if I don't name him. That is the worst planning in the world. I don't care if you're the oldest son. I don't care if you're the youngest girl. I don't care. You've got to boil down to who has the ability to make that decision. And will they stand up and do what you want? And if it's the youngest child, then let them do it. Because talking about it in my office is sure a lot easier than with that red light of the ambulance flashing in the emergency room. And that mm-hmm. child has to decide whether a parent lives or dies. If it's your sister, name your sister. If it's that person is more critical than the executor. I mean, the executor maybe mm-hmm. doesn't make the best financial decision, but you have to convince people to name the best individual and not be worried about feelings when it comes to that.
Yeah. And I think that I'm sure that one of the questions people have, they have certainly have the question about living will, but perhaps also for these documents as well, they're concerned about whether, in fact, what that spells out will be followed, and that when it comes time that it, maybe they're in that kind of situation, that the people taking care of them are actually going to do what these papers say.
They don't always. I have a case of a wonderful family where mom and dad had these powers of attorney for health care. And when the dad got in the hospital with a heart attack, the son could not make the decision to let him go. And he lived another 3 months, but not quality of life. And that's not mm-hmm. what the dad wanted. So that's why I say you have to try to dig into the people's real feelings to tell you if that child's going to do, or the friend or this brother is going to do what they're supposed to. Because if they don't, then it doesn't get done.
Okay. Well, we've talked about a number of things. We've answered a lot of questions, which was my hope. Any last thing that if there's something we didn't touch on that you might want to mention real quick?
Well, someday you may have to have me back, but someday I'd like to talk about the cost of hiring a lawyer, because I have people who go to maybe a traveling group that sell trusts, and all I'm telling you is, before you decide lawyers are too expensive, and they are expensive, but to fix my car usually costs $1,500 anymore, go find out what the cost is, because it may be about a fraction of what people think sometimes.
All right. Our guest this morning, this hour, John Elder. He's an attorney with the firm of Meyer Capel in Champaign. Thanks very much for being here.
It's been fun, David. Thanks.